Well, good evening.
Good evening.
Well, you've had a better day since we last talked, I see. Y'all just aren't morning people. That may be it. Well, we've been studying in the book of Genesis, and don't worry, we're not going to stay in the Old Testament forever. Only 5 or 10 years. Now, after we finish Genesis, which will take us quite some time, there's a lot of chapters in Genesis and a lot of great information and great background and foundation for our faith as Christians in the book of Genesis. Even though, well, there weren't any Christians back then. Well, there may not be, but remember, Abraham's the father of the faithful. Well, he's in there. And so there are a lot of others as well, a lot of things that we can learn. We can help young people learn about marriage in the book of Genesis with Isaac and Rebekah, and all sorts of things we can learn there. We've been studying about Noah and the flood, and Genesis 9 and 10, we're going to try to tackle two again tonight. Chapter 10 in particular really is, because it's just a genealogy, it's not as much in it. And although it is something that some people spend their whole lives studying there in Genesis chapter 10, but we're not going to spend that much time on it. The end of Genesis 8, if you'll recall, the Lord has called Noah and his family out of the ark, and they're on dry land again, and of course the earth has been cleansed of its wickedness. All of the wicked people are dead and gone, and so it's starting afresh. And so here they are, and the first thing that God does after calling them out of the ark is to bless Noah and his sons and to tell them, and I think this latter command was directed primarily at the sons, to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. I don't know if Noah and his wife had any more children, but I kind of doubt it. Those three were theirs. But he promises them blessings. He blesses them. And he's going to be with them, and he's going to watch over them. And now, this is the first time that we have mention of him speaking to Noah's sons. Always before, he had spoken to Noah. Remember, we talked about the patriarchal age, where God spoke to the father of the family. Well, at this point, apparently, he's considering now, you got Noah, and that's his family, but now he's taking each of these three sons, and he's moving them up. They're now going to be the heads of their family. And these three families then are going to repopulate and replenish the entire earth. So if we're here tonight, and I think we all are, at least physically, if not mentally, and if we're here, if we're alive on the earth today, and everyone who's alive on the earth today, descended from these three boys, I say boys, they're 100 years old, but these three sons of Noah and their three wives. So you either came from Shem, Ham, or Japheth. And we're going to look at a little bit of the breakdown of that when we get into chapter 10. Because these are the only people alive on the earth at that point. God's going to make some changes in the law. Things are going to be different than they were before the flood. And here are some of the changes he makes. In verse 2, he's going to put the fear of man into the animals. Remember, all of these animals came to Noah to get in the ark. They just came to him. Now, how many wild animals do you know that would come to you? No, see, God put the fear of man into the animals. These animals, they weren't afraid of man. They've been being taken care of by man for the last year on that ark. But God was going to put the fear of man into them for their own good, I might add. And we'll see that in just a moment. But he's going to put the dread of man into them. Now, that doesn't mean that every animal in the world is scared of every human being in the world. But have you noticed that for the most part, wild animals tend to try to stay away from people? Now, sometimes you'll get one that gets a little crazy and attacks somebody. I saw something about a leopard that attacked 9 or 11 people this past week, but that's unusual. That's an odd thing. For the most part, those animals, you know, they get out in the woods, they get out in the water, they go away from people. They don't hang out in the cities with the people. They get away. And so God put that fear into them. But he also changes the dietary law. Do you remember back to when we talked about Adam and Eve? And we talked about the fact that they were vegetarians, that they were, well, really vegans. They didn't eat any meat products, any animal products at all, according to what God told them, I've given you the plants, the herbs of the field. Well, now he's changing that law. In verse number 3, he says, every moving thing that lives shall be meat for you. Even as the green herb have I given you all things. Now, I want us to think about how important that is. If you're not a Jew, and that's all of us, as far as I know, none of you are Jews. If you're not a Jew, and you weren't ever a descendant of Abraham, then you, as far as a Gentile, were under the dietary laws that God put in place with Noah. There are a lot of Christian people, and I'll put that in quotes, there are a lot of people who claim to be Christian who try to impose certain dietary restrictions on Christians. We don't have any. God gave every living thing. Now, he does give one caveat to that. In verse 4, he says, but flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, you shall not eat. Don't eat the blood. Of course, the New Testament tells us that over in the book of Acts, that the Gentiles even were taught, don't eat the blood with the meat. So we don't eat blood. But other than that, every living thing can be food for us. Now, there are a lot of animals that we don't want to eat, and we don't eat them. But if we were hungry enough and needed to eat them, it wouldn't be a sin for us to eat them. Most of us are very disgusted by the idea of some of the peoples in the world who eat cats and dogs. We tell stories about those people that eat cats and dogs. It's okay for them to eat that. And we don't want to eat them because we have cats and dogs for pets, and we don't want to eat our pets. But that's okay. God gave every living thing. All the animals are now fair game. Now, he restricts that with the Jews under the law of Moses. They don't get to keep eating everything. He makes some very strict restrictions. We had something for lunch today that was, I thought was pretty good, but that if I were a Jew, I couldn't eat. We had pork. Can't eat that if you're a Jew. But because I'm under this law, and the law of Christ doesn't change that restriction, doesn't limit any other things that I can't eat as far as animals go, I can still eat that pork. I can eat my bacon and my sausage and all those things. But that's a very important change. People went from being vegetarians till now they can eat plants and animals, and any of the animals. And so people often point back to Adam and Eve, but they forget that this is a more recent law. And what do we know about laws? The new law supersedes the old law. So when Noah's new dietary laws were put into effect, then that old law of Adam and Eve didn't have to be followed anymore. Now, that doesn't mean that it's a sin for somebody to be a vegetarian. If they want to be a vegetarian, they're free to do that. But they don't have the right to condemn someone who doesn't do that. And that's a very important thing. That's one of those things about the freedom that God gives us in so many areas, that we have the right to do it and not condemn somebody else if they don't want to do it. Verse 5 and 6, another apparent change in the law, or at least an enunciation of a law that had never been stated before. Do you ever wonder why after Cain killed Abel, he wasn't executed? Apparently that wasn't the law then. Look at verses 5 and 6. Surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it. At the hand of man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man. So God makes a new law. Or at least he states it very clearly. If you kill somebody, you're going to die. You should die. That's God's law. Now, we've come up with all sorts of reasons why that law isn't, oh, we're not going, this person was sick, or they had this mental problem, and animal, was it the orca whale that ate, killed the trainer? Orca's back doing shows now, killer whale back doing its shows. It wasn't put to death. God said it should have been. That animal killed a human being that was created in the image of God. That animal should have been put to death. And I know they came up with also, well, it was the trainer's own fault and all these kinds of things. This fellow over in Norway, I don't know if you've seen anything about that. It's been all over the news, you know, the last several hours. But he killed 92 people between the bomb and the shooting. 92 people. And you know what the news said last night? He might have to spend 21 years in jail for killing 92 people? See, we're getting far, far away from God's law. God's law that He gave after the flood to Noah said, you kill somebody, you deserve to die. Now, I understand about mercy and all of those things, but the book of Proverbs tells us that wickedness continues to increase because justice is not swift. Because we don't punish the evildoer. You know, I know people say, well, it's not a deterrent. It is a deterrent. God made the law to stop people from killing each other. Because if you knew that killing somebody was going to mean you had to die, well, there are some people that are crazy enough that they don't care because they're going to kill everybody and then turn the gun on themselves or whatever anyway. They're going to kill themselves. But here we are. People got far, far away from God's law. And they allowed murder to go unpunished. It's a sad situation. But these are some of the laws that God changed. And then, of course, in verse 7, He reiterates, you be fruitful and you multiply. God makes a covenant as He speaks to Noah and his sons in verses 8 and following. He makes a covenant with them and with their descendants to all generations, to even to us. This is the first promise God ever made to you. So pay close attention. He's making us a promise. Now I know He made the promise about the seed time and harvest at the end of chapter 8. But here He has this new promise. He says, I'm going to establish my covenant with you, verse 11 says, both with you and with every beast of the earth, verse 10 it said. But He says there in verse 11, neither shall all flesh be cut off any more by the waters of a flood. Neither shall there any more be a flood to destroy the earth. He said, I'm never going to do that again. I destroyed everything with this flood. I'm never going to do that again. And we can have security in knowing that. Never again will He flood the whole earth. Doesn't mean there won't be local floods. Doesn't mean that one of us may not die in a flood. It could happen. But not the whole world. It's not going to destroy the whole world. Guess how He's doing it next time. It used to be a song that said, you know, about God warning Noah about the rain, and he saved Noah, and the chorus of the song said, it won't be water, but fire next time. I tell you what, drowning in water is one thing, drowning in fire, I don't know which would be worse. But next time, the whole earth is going to be destroyed. It's going to be destroyed completely. Not just washed off. It's going to completely burn up and be gone. And we talked about that back when we studied Matthew 24 about the end of the world. That it's going to be gone. There's not going to be any ground left. There's not going to be any water left. There's not going to be anything left next time. When it gets that bad again, He's just going to destroy everything. And then God introduces the idea of a token in order to confirm a covenant. Any of you have ever received a token to confirm a covenant? I don't know. How many of you have a wedding ring or had one? That's a token to confirm a covenant that you made. You made a covenant with that person you married that I'm going to be your spouse and we're going to live together as husband and wife. And that's a token. It's not, it's just a ring. A gold ring Doesn't mean anything. Even with a diamond on it, it might be worth some money, but it doesn't mean anything. It's just a gold ring with a diamond. But when you put that on, as you've said your vows and made that promise, I'm going to love, honor, and cherish whatever, you know, whatever your vows were, till death do us part, you promised that you were going to do what you should do as a spouse. And that's, every time you see that, it should remind you. You notice I don't have one on. I don't have to remember those vows. No. Mine won't fit anymore. I got too fat. But one of the reasons that that's there is to remind us of those vows I made, those promises, my side of that covenant. Well, God introduces that out. He says, I'm going to make this promise. And He makes the promise. And then He says, now, I'm going to give you a token, and there's going to be this token that's going to remind us all of the promise that I made, of this covenant that we have now, that I'm never going to destroy the earth with a flood again. How many of you know what that token is? We've seen it. That rainbow. He puts the rainbow in the sky as a reminder to Him never to flood the world again. Now, not that He needed a reminder. God's not that forgetful. Although sometimes in His anger, He might have been very tempted to go ahead and flood it anyway. But that reminded Him. Every time it rains, somebody somewhere, if they're at the right angle to see it, as we know how it works, you know, with the light reflecting and everything, somebody somewhere can see a rainbow there. Every time it rains, that rainbow. And it not only reminds Him, but it's there to remind us. It's sad that in our world today, the rainbow's become nothing more than a light refraction phenomenon. That's all it is. It's, you know, the light bounces off the water molecules and it scatters the light into its different colors and wavelengths. And you know, there's all sorts of scientific terminology to explain how it happens. They missed the point. You know, that'd be kind of like studying the chemical makeup of your wedding ring. Well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if that ring's made out of plastic if it still reminds you that you're married to that person. But God gave that rainbow in the sky, a reminder to Him not to flood it, a reminder to us of the promise He made, never to flood it again. And so God introduced the idea of a token. And all through Scripture, there will be tokens of covenants. One of the most famous is the token Abraham and God had to confirm their covenant, which was circumcision. But there are other tokens all over the place. And like I said, we still use them, for example, the wedding band. Of course, a lot of our covenants now are written documents, and we have a copy of the document. Then that's basically our token that we know that we have that covenant and those promises that have been made. And people don't seem to care. They sign a promissory note. We don't talk about promissory notes anymore, but you know, they used to sign a promissory note, but they don't pay it. They just walk away. We don't keep our promises. That's a sad thing. But God, fortunately for us, does keep His promises. If He kept His promises the way most people keep their promises, we'd all been dead a long time ago. He would have wiped us all out. But when God sees that, when the rain comes, the rainbow comes, He'll see the rainbow, He'll remember the covenant, and He won't flood the earth. Okay, verse 18, the sons of Noah that went out of the ark, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham is the father of Canaan. These are the three sons of Noah, and of them the whole earth was spread over. You ever notice that even righteous people do wrong sometimes? They still make mistakes. They're not perfect. Noah, righteous, just, upright, perfect in his generations, but not perfect. Not compared to God. Well, Noah planted a vineyard. He made some wine from that vineyard. He got drunk on that wine, and he went and lay uncovered or naked in his tent. Well, at least he was in his tent. Nobody should have ever known much more than that about the situation. Well, he got drunk and went in his tent. Unfortunately, Noah's son Ham went in to his father's tent and saw the nakedness of his father. Some have indicated that there's a possibility here of more than just seeing. Some of them have said that there might have been some sort of homosexual activity involved there. It's not in the text. But the phrase, see the nakedness of, often in the book of Leviticus, refers to sexual encounters. So it's within the realm of possibility, even though it's not specifically there. But at the very least, he saw his father in a compromised position, and he went out and told his other brothers about it. And when he told those other brothers about it, they went in walking backwards so they wouldn't see their father naked, with a blanket over their shoulders, and covered him up so that his nakedness wouldn't be out there for everyone to see. But verse 24 says, when Noah awoke and knew what his younger son had done. He knew what his younger son had done to him. He was angry. Now this, of course, is one of the things that makes people think it was more than just walking in seeing his dad without his clothes on, that he was angry about this situation. But the mocking of it, the going out and telling his brothers about it, all of that entered in, and Noah was angry. Verse 25 is one I've never quite understood, though. He didn't curse Ham. He cursed Ham's son, Canaan. That seems kind of mean. He cursed somebody who didn't do anything. Canaan didn't do it. Why are you going to curse him for it? But he says, cursed be Canaan, and he says that Canaan's going to have to serve Shem, and Canaan's going to have to serve Japheth. But it's interesting that when we went back and we looked at Noah giving birth, well, fathering, I don't guess he gave birth, his wife did. We don't even know her name. Isn't that something? She's one of only four women on earth. We don't even know her name. But when she gave birth to those sons, it says that Noah was 500 and became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. But when we read that, we often think, well, they must have been triplets. They must have all been the same age. But they're not. They're not the same. In fact, Japheth is the eldest, Ham is the youngest, and Shem is the middle child of the three. We know that from here in verse 24 where he says that Ham was the younger. In chapter 10 and verse 21, it tells us that Japheth was the eldest, or elder son. So Japheth was the oldest, Ham the youngest, and then Shem was in the middle. Noah lived another 350 years. He was 950 years old when he died. He's the last one that's going to live those long, long ages. Now, Shem's going to live over 900. He's going to live a long time. But it starts to drop dramatically after this. Something changed at the time of the flood, that people didn't live as long as they did before the flood. Some people might claim it's because they weren't vegetarians anymore. But some religious Bible-believing scientists believe that something changed in the atmosphere. That when those windows of heaven opened up and all that rain came down, and that changed the makeup of the atmosphere and allowed more of the sun's harmful radiation to come through. And so we don't live as long as we used to. But then in chapter 10, and we don't have a lot to look at here in chapter 10, so we'll go through this quicker. This is a table or a description of, a listing of Noah's descendants, Noah's sons and their descendants. Whenever you read, now these are the generations of, you're going to read about some descendants and things. And that's what's going to happen here. So here we have Noah's descendants. And remember that all of us come from them. And this is where some people have studied for years think somebody's in trouble. Those three sons, Japheth and Shem and Ham, they spread out to different places. Their descendants spread out to different places. A lot of people have put a lot of study into who and where those children went. And you can trace to some degree where they went based on the names of their children and based on the names that were given to places where those people spread out. Now, we know that Louisiana had a French background, not only by the name of the state, but by the name of a lot of the places in the state of Louisiana. There were some French people that lived here and named things after with French names. Well, the same thing is true when we look at different places around the world. We have a little bit of information about that. And we don't want to go into too much detail on that, but suffice it to say, of course, that Japheth and Ham, all of them were Gentiles. Well, even a lot of Shem's descendants are Gentiles. Remember, only Jacob's sons and their descendants are Jews. According to the Jews, everybody else is Gentiles. So that's it. Just Jacob's sons and his descendants. But we have Japheth's descendants in verses 2 through 5, and it says, the isles of the Gentiles in verse 5. Well, this indicates the area up from Mesopotamia, which is an area near where we would find Saudi Arabia and places like that today, up toward the Mediterranean where there are a lot of islands, Greece area, and up in there, but on up into Europe. And most of Japheth's descendants moved up into the European areas as well as up into what we would call Eastern Europe or Russia and Western Asia, even up into there. Ham's descendants. And it's interesting that Ham means dark one. Ham was darker complexed than his other two brothers. I don't know why. I don't know if Noah or his wife, one of them may have been dark skinned. But Ham means dark one. And his descendants went south. Cush, Mizraim, Put, and then of course Canaan that stayed in the Canaanites, they stayed in Canaan. But Cush moved down into Ethiopia, and Mizraim moved down to Egypt, and Put, that's down in Libya and places. So they moved down into Africa. His descendants moved that direction. So those that are from Africa, they probably descended from Ham. Those that are from European background, probably descended from Japheth. Those with the Middle Eastern background, they were probably descendants of Shem. Elam and Asher, Arphaxad, Lud and Aram, those are some of the names of places that we find over in the Middle East. Places we find in areas like Iran and Assyria, the Chaldeans, Syria, that area of the world. Probably some of those that moved in the area of Russia, Romania, Ukraine, some of those moved on further east. Some, of course, wound up moving all the way over to China and Japan, and some, of course, they studied all these things and where these people came from and moved from, and we don't have all the answers to that. God didn't intend to give us all the answers to that. But He gives us some little insights into some of those things. One of the most interesting things about this section is verse number 25, however. One of the descendants of Eber, and Eber is the one from whom the Hebrews get their name. Abraham was a Hebrew. He was a descendant of Eber. And he was a Hebrew. He wasn't a Jew. I know that the kids sometimes, vacation Bible schools and things, they think, once there were three wandering Jews, and they sing about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Abraham and Isaac weren't Jews. They were wandering men, but they weren't Jews. The Jews didn't exist yet. Because Jacob is the one who was renamed Israel. And of course we see those things happening later on in Genesis. But in verse 25, unto Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, because in his days was the earth divided. Do you remember back when we talked about the days of creation? That the water was all gathered into one place and the dry land appeared? But somewhere here after the flood, the earth was divided. Well, now we talk about, well, they talk about seven continents, but it's not really fair to call Europe and Asia two continents because they're connected. But we've got these big, huge landmass separated by ocean waters. When did that all happen? Had to have happened as most likely a result of the flood and the changes that took place on the earth. We know that the world is not what it once was. Peter tells us the earth that then was is destroyed, being overflowed with water, and it's no more. And then he says, and the earth that now is, it's a, and I know it's the same planet, it's still earth, but it's not the same world. We live on the same planet, but it's not the same as what Adam and Eve knew. The climate's different, everything's different. It's a changed place. It's very different. And apparently, some of that happened in the days of Peleg. This also may have reference to what we'll find out about in chapter 11 with the Tower of Babel. The people on earth were divided in chapter 11, and it could have been that that occurred during his lifetime. It could have been that those two events coincided, that the division of languages and the division of groups of people and the division of the land masses that they lived on could have all occurred at a similar time, at the same time. In verse 31, we have a little bit of foreshadowing. As he's talked about all of these descendants of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, he says, these are the sons of Shem after their families, after their tongues, in their lands, after their nations. Now, of course, at the time that Noah and his sons came off the ark, there weren't any nations. There weren't any other tongues. They all spoke the same language. But he's foreshadowing. He's talking about some changes that are going to take place. And then in chapter 11, he's going to detail some of those changes that take place. Also in chapter 10, in verses 8 and 9, we find Nimrod. He was a mighty hunter. But this mighty hunter was also the first one to have a kingdom. And his kingdom began, guess where? At Babel. The first kingdom on earth was a kingdom that rebelled against God and against His will. And kingdoms have been doing that ever since. Groups of people have been getting together and outvoting God and deciding they want to do different than what God says. It's been happening since way back here. His kingdom began in the plains of Shinar, in Babel, where that tower was built to rebel against God. That was the beginning of his kingdom. I know that some of these things maybe seem just, oh well, that's kind of interesting, but how is that important? What's important about these things is that they show that God, as He wrote the Bible, He understood and He knew and He allowed Moses to know, to be able to write these things down, to know these things that there's no way Moses could have known these events. Moses wasn't there. All of these things that are written and the fact that we verify a lot of these similar things that we can find out, trace back history and archaeological digs, and they find out all sorts of things. And every time they find something, it agrees with the Bible and what the Bible had already said. I can remember so many times that archaeologists, scientists would say, well, this didn't happen, that didn't happen. And then they go and the more they study it, the more they realize, well, guess what? the Bible was right after all. The Bible talks about all of these things. And it's an accurate record. If it wasn't accurate in these little minor details, then why would we trust our soul to the things that are written in this book? Jesus said, whoever is faithful in little will be faithful in much. If we can trust God on these little things and say, well, that's not even significant, everything's significant. God didn't write this just for the fun of writing. He detailed it as evidence of Him so that we could have faith in Him and faith in His Word. Because even though we might say, well, it doesn't matter where Japheth's descendants went or where Ham's descendants went or Shem's descendants went. No, it doesn't. It really doesn't matter. But the fact that the Bible records it accurately does matter. If you're going to record something, you better record it accurately if you're going to claim that that's the Word of God. It better be right. But the fact that the Bible is right in even little details, little small things that seem insignificant, is more evidence that our faith is on a firm foundation. Tonight, if you have a need to respond to the invitation, perhaps you haven't had the faith that you should have in the Lord and in His Word. Perhaps you need to dig deeper into His Word to understand it better, to learn more about it. Perhaps you need to trust His promises. Maybe you're living a life of constant fear because you don't trust in God. As we grow in our knowledge, we were looking at this in our Netcasters class before we began. Peter says that when we grow in the knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ, grace and peace are multiplied to us. We have a better life, a more peaceful life, when we have more knowledge of the Bible. If you need to respond to the invitation tonight for any reason, we ask that you do so as we stand and as we sing.